From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry flying into Kiev tomorrow as Russian-backed forces pound on eastern Ukraine. Heavy artillery from both sides, billowing smoke, serious attacks. There is a new call in Washington and beyond for the U.S. to give lethal aid to Ukraine. Tough economic sanctions haven't backed Russia down. But should the U.S. arm Ukraine up in the face of Moscow and Vladimir Putin? This hour on Point, lethal aid to Ukraine. Later in this hour, we will go to Jordan. The government there has hanged two jailed jihadists after ISIS released a video showing the apparent burning death of a captured Jordanian pilot. But first, the rough Ukraine story. Joining me now from Moscow, well, behind us right there, there's the sound of heavy artillery in Uglegorsk, close to Debaltseve, from a video published by Ukraine War News on January 31st. You can hear just how intense it has been. With us now from Moscow is NPR's Corey Flintoff. He's just been reporting from battered eastern Ukraine where fighting has been stiff. Corey, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
We were very struck by the sound you collected on your time in eastern Ukraine. This is not scattered gunfire or anything like it. It sounded like rolling thunder, Corey.
No. In fact, what you just played is a pretty good illustration of what you hear in any of these hotspots around all along the front where these two sides are facing off. It is absolutely near constant shelling, night and day.
When did it rev up again, and what's the current state of things? What's the apparent objective?
Well, you know, the ceasefire never really took hold. There was always a certain amount of shelling going on, but things really revved up a few weeks ago. I think the separatists in eastern Ukraine kind of abandoned the pretext that there was going to be any peace agreement or that there was going to be any following of the so-called Minsk agreements that were passed in September. They launched offensives, especially coming out of Donetsk, at this town that you mentioned just a bit ago, Debaltseve, along all this entire front, including even down in the around the port city of Mariupol. What the separatists have said is that they intend to push the line back, push the Ukrainians back, so that they're at least out of artillery range of major cities in the land that they claim to be an independent republic. And they've said that ultimately they intend to push them all the way back to the original borders of these two provinces in the east, Luhansk and Donetsk.
If they take Luhansk and Donetsk, what have they got in terms of industrial infrastructure, in terms of what it means to Ukraine, in terms of what it means to Moscow?
Well, frankly, it's not the sort of industrial powerhouse that some people would lead you to believe. You know, it's kind of a rust belt area. Where there are mines and metal works that are no longer very efficient or very productive, but they have been carrying a lot of what amounts to industrial production for Ukraine for the last 20 years. And, it would be a significant loss to Ukraine, especially an energy loss. It's a big coal mining area, for instance.
You were out there talking with people in these towns and villages along the edges of the cities. What do they think is coming toward them? Do they think it's inevitable that the separatists will take this turf, or is it still up in the air?
You know, I talked to a lot of people on the Ukrainian side in towns that at one point were actually in the hands of the separatists, places like Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. And there are many people there who actually sympathize with the separatists. So I think they wouldn't regret it if that land were to be captured back. But I would say that, you know, for most people, I mean, they simply don't want any part of this. They're, you know, what we heard from most people, and especially the people that were in the greatest distress or under the greatest threat, was that what they really want is peace. I think a lot of people never aligned one way or the other.
What does Kiev want, the capital of Ukraine at this point? Do they want just a ceasefire? Do they want the separatists to give it all back? What's their desire?
Well, they're keeping their cards pretty close to the chest. I think that there's a feeling from analysts that I've talked to, at least, that Ukraine would probably make significant concessions if they could obtain a real ceasefire And if they could maintain the line of the ceasefire where it was in the Minsk agreement, which was would have given the separatists probably a little bit less than half of the land that they want.
And John Kerry flying into Kiev tomorrow, is he expected, after all the talk this week about lethal aid, is he expected to bring an offer of arms, fresh arms, lethal arms for Kiev?
You know, the question is whether that would really be worthwhile. You know, there's no question about the fact that Ukraine is outgunned. In fact, you know, all indications are that Russia is providing its best trained troops and top of the line equipment to the separatists. There have been a lot of really clever online journalists and investigators who've been examining videos and photographs from the war zone. They've been examining this equipment, and they say that there's proof that Russia's providing, you know, the latest generation of tanks and armored vehicles, things that have never seen service outside of Russia before. So, you know, it seems that Ukraine is being forced back now from these most contested areas, Donetsk and Debaltseve. It's a surprise, really, that the Ukrainians have been able to put up such a determined fight. But, you know, even if the United States started providing the Ukrainians with weaponry that's comparable to what Russia is providing, it seems very unlikely that it would be any help in the current fighting. You know, I mean, for one thing, it takes time to transport that equipment to Ukraine, and it takes much more time to train Ukrainian soldiers to use it. So we're probably talking about weaponry that wouldn't really be effective in battle for weeks, if not months.
Corey Flintoff, NPR's Moscow correspondent. Corey, thank you for your reporting from the front in eastern Ukraine. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
On January 21st, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko spoke at the NATO summit in Wales, asking Russia to get out of Ukraine.
More than 9,000 troops of Russian Federation on my territory, including more than 500 tanks and heavy artillery and armed personnel carrier. If this is not an aggression, what is the aggression?
If this is not an aggression, what is an aggression? But should the United States provide lethal aid? Joining me now from Washington is Stephen Pieper, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He was one of eight prominent American signers of a new report calling for lethal aid, U.S. aid, to Ukraine. Its title, Preserving Ukraine's Independence, Resisting Russian Aggression, What the U.S. and NATO Must Do. He was ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Ambassador Pieper, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What's at the heart of your argument? Why provide lethal aid?
Well, as Corey Flintoff just described, the ceasefire that was agreed in September has completely broken down. You've seen the separatists and their Russian supporters with both Russian troops and Russian equipment conducting new offensives. And therefore, our group, we took a look. Several of us traveled to both NATO headquarters and also to Ukraine in mid-January. And our recommendation is for significant military assistance to Ukraine, although I'd note that most of what we recommend is non-lethal assistance. For example, radars that would allow the Ukrainians to pinpoint the source of rocket and artillery attacks, which are causing about 70% of Ukrainian casualties. We do argue for a change in policy to provide some lethal defensive weapons. These would be light anti-armor weapons. And that's driven in large part by what we heard both in Ukraine but also at NATO, that they've seen over the last 2 months a significant influx of Russian armor into eastern Ukraine.
But
I just might say the goal of this is not to prolong the war. The goal here is to give the Ukrainians the ability to raise the cost of aggression to the Russians and hopefully then bring the Russians to a real negotiation, which hasn't really happened.
You say light anti-armor weapons, but that would be American weapons taking out Russian tanks. What are the risks of the U.S. getting quickly into a proxy or worse conflict with Russia right there?
Well, there's a couple of points here. I mean, some people say, is there a risk here of escalation? And we acknowledge there may be risk, but would point out a couple things in response. First of all, the Russians have escalated this conflict continuously since last March. Second, we don't actually then fall onto this escalation ladder. All of our group were very clear we did not want to see U.S. troops, and nobody in Ukraine said they wanted to see American forces there. They are prepared to conduct the conflict. They are prepared to fight to defend their own territory. And bear in mind, we are talking about Russian forces invading, fighting on Ukrainian territory. They want the equipment. So, you know, is there a danger of escalation? Perhaps. But also, I think Vladimir Putin is still, he makes rational calculations. If he sees the cost of this aggression go up, and he's been very sensitive about Russian casualties. So, for example, we've seen reports of the Russians burying dead soldiers at night. disgraceful things like telling injured soldiers that if you disclose that you were injured in Ukraine, you lose your disability pension. So there's a sensitivity there. And we think that there is an opportunity to change the calculus in Moscow and, again, shift them more towards a negotiated outcome rather than this continued fighting.
Ambassador Pfeiffer, I get the sensitivity on casualties. They don't want the Russian people to see that. But you describe, you know, raising the cost to Russia. The cost to Russia of the economic sanctions has been monumental already. Surely the cost you're describing here, the incremental cost of going up against a few more American weapons, is peanuts compared to that.
Well, I would argue that both of these things work together. The economic sanctions, which are causing significant damage to the Russian economy, and then if the Ukrainians have an increased capability to defend themselves, to inflict costs on any further Russian aggression, those two factors work together. And again, the idea here is to get the Russians to sit down and negotiate in a serious way with Ukraine. And unfortunately, that has not yet happened. We're trying to change that calculus in Moscow.
Do you think John Kerry will have this in his valise when he arrives in Kiev tomorrow? Is he now? There's been a lot of talk about this. Is he coming with an offer of stiffer lethal aid, more arms, more weaponry?
Members of our group briefed this report to a number of senior U.S. officials, including last week at both the State Department and the Department of Defense. And I would say that there was interest in our ideas. What we heard was this is a very live issue in the U.S. government. But my guess is that Secretary Kerry is not going to have that decision yet.
Certainly on the table now in Washington. The top commander at NATO is calling for it. Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer is with us, one of eight signatories to this report saying, let's do it. He was U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Ambassador Pfeiffer, please stand by. We're talking about arming Ukraine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about arming Ukraine, giving lethal aid, arms and more to the government now under heavy attack by Russian-backed separatists, looking at whether the U.S. should do it, whether it should, in effect, go nose to nose with Moscow and Vladimir Putin here. Hear the sound of artillery explosions around the nearly crippled international airport in Donetsk. It has been rough in recent days. Hear residents in Debaltseve in eastern Ukraine earlier this week telling a reporter they have no electricity, no coal, no central heating because of the fighting between Russian-backed rebels and Ukrainian troops. As they speak, a bomb goes off in the background.
Ничего нет в городе. Все магазины закрыты кругом.
Who's in there? A lot of Ukrainians, a lot of Russians. In early January, the BBC interviewed a Russian volunteer, Pavel, who explained why he was fighting in eastern Ukraine.
This is a holy war of the Russian people fighting for our future, for our ideals, for our children, and our great country that 25 years ago was divided up into pieces.
Over the weekend, President Obama sounding cautious on this front, telling CNN's Fareed Zakaria he favors diplomacy.
To those who would suggest that we need to do more, what I've said to them is that we can exact higher and higher costs, and that's exactly what we're doing, and we can bring diplomatic pressure to bear. I don't think that it would be wise for the United States or the world to see an actual military conflict between the United States and Russia.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Stephen Pfeiffer is with us. Ambassador to Ukraine, is that the sound of the American president saying no thank you to your idea even before the full report came out?
Well, again, what I can say is that I think this is a very live issue now within the administration, and we'll have to see. But I would say I think my co-authors, we would all agree with the president. The answer to the conflict in eastern Ukraine needs to be a diplomatic one. It needs to be a political settlement. The problem is now that you have the Russians who are pursuing the military solution, and a way needs to be found to discourage the Russians from that and bring them also to a more diplomatic track.
So you think that if they met stiffer resistance on the ground in eastern Ukraine, they would show up at the negotiating table when they haven't, after all the punishment that they've taken economically and more in the last year?
Well, we think that there is a strong chance that this would happen. And again, the Russian options, I mean, there's a fear of Russian escalation, but those options are actually not all that easy and have risks. Corey mentioned earlier that the Russian separatists or the separatists supported by the Russians have talked about taking all of Donetsk and all of Luhansk.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my co-authors and I, we visited Kramatorsk, which is the Ukrainian field headquarters in northwestern Donetsk about 3 weeks ago. And yes, there are people there who are sympathetic to the Russians, but there's also a lot of very strong pro-Ukrainian sentiment. And I think one of the dilemmas the Russians may face if they consider escalation is the more territory they take now, the more they're going to occupy where the population is hostile to the Russians. And we heard a lot of talk when we were in Kyiv about preparations for partisan warfare if the Russians come further west.
Well, what are you pushing back on here then? You don't want to see anything chipped away from Ukraine as it formally is laid out on the map? Or you're worried that if Russia isn't stopped this time, we'll see more of this in other former Soviet territory?
Well, there's 2 points. I mean, the first point, again, is to steer this conflict away from the battlefield, away from the horrible sounds that you're hearing when Corey Flintoff was there recently, to steer it towards the negotiating table. And thus far, the Russians have not been prepared to negotiate seriously or use their influence with the separatist leaders to get them to negotiate. But there is a second point here, which is that this is a concern that our group had, that it's not just about Ukraine, that if the Kremlin comes away and believes that it can get away with this kind of hybrid warfare on the cheap, are we confronted with these tactics somewhere else, perhaps in a place like Estonia or Latvia, both of which are members of NATO, to which the United States has a security guarantee?
You say Russian escalation, I guess that you mean in Ukraine, but you say that it, in a way it's low risk because how would the U.S. and Russia itself actually come to blows here? But where does this stop? I mean, if you do this, and Vladimir Putin's very chest-puffing about all this, it's a very nationalist thing. He's willing to take punishment. That's clear on the economic front. What's the guarantee that we don't get into some kind of real nose-to-nose with Russia somehow, somewhere out of this?
Yeah. Well, again, I reject the analogy that says once you start down this path, the ultimate destination is going to be American troops on the ground. Nobody in our group argues for that. We heard nobody in Ukraine asking for American troops. And so I think we can build in fire breaks. And we should be clear with the Ukrainians. If we provide this amount of military assistance, we need to say, this is what you're getting. You're not getting American troops. I think that's probably also well understood in Moscow. But again, we're talking about looking at ways to fill some significant gaps that the Ukrainian military faces now that would give them the capability to defend their own territory better against separatists who are backed by Russian invaders.
We're going to hear pushback in just a moment on the whole idea. Let me get my callers in, if I may. Ambassador Pfeiffer, please stand by. Vladimir is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Vladimir, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
What do you think?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear, you're on.
Yeah, okay. I'm an associate professor of Slavic studies at Brown University. I wrote a bunch of articles about this conflict. I traveled to Russia, of course, because of my research. And I want to bring a couple of points, which I'm not sure are being aired here, and I'm not sure that American public in general is aware. Point number one, Russians are very much committed to seeing things through the way they want to see it to happen in Ukraine. They perceive events in Ukraine as an act of Western aggression. They perceive the events in Ukraine as West pushing NATO to their borders. That's why they are willing to undergo a tremendous amount of punishment, which your speakers talk about.
Yep.
And they are willing to escalate into it further and further. And being right there at the border, next to that, they have tremendous amount of things at their disposal. So I perceive it as if Americans push further with little aid, whatever, it's this Cold War will escalate into hot war, including nuclear arms. So it's, as far as our audience is willing to go to the war over Ukraine, and this is my second point, not the liberal West-looking Ukraine, as many of your speakers project, but this Ukraine mired in corruption and lawlessness. So if we are willing to go for this war, that's fine. Let's, our representatives, our president, State Department, clarify it to American public. It's worth the price. But I'm not sure it's worth the price, escalating the thing for the sake of corrupt Ukraine, for the sake of bullying Russia, which has already showed its resoluteness.
Bullying Russia, I mean, I know there are different perspectives on this. I know there's another Russian perspective. Russia can look pretty bullying right now from the other side. But Vladimir, we've got it. Let me take it to Ambassador Pfeiffer. Where is the fire break? If we get into this, where is the point beyond which Russia won't escalate in response?
Yeah, well, I guess I would make 3 points in response. First, the caller talked about Western aggression and this perception in Russia. That may be the perception in Russia, but the reality is it's Russian troops that are supporting and are fighting in eastern Ukraine on Ukrainian territory. And the second point is that while the caller says that this has great support in Russia, I think actually right now Putin's policy towards Ukraine has support. But also, if you look at polls in Russia over the last 6 months, those polls show consistently that large majorities of Russians, while they may support the policy, do not want the Russian army fighting in Ukraine, which I think explains why the Kremlin has gone to these extraordinary and disgraceful efforts to hide the fact that Russian soldiers are dying there. The third point on escalation, again, I think you can build in fire breaks that make sure that this does not escalate beyond the point that we wish.
It's not all forward advance by Russians. Here's the sound of Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine running for cover from Ukrainian forces this week. And here, State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki Monday responding to calls for military aid to Ukraine.
Our focus does remain on pursuing a solution through diplomatic means, and we are always evaluating other options that will help create space for a negotiated solution to the crisis.
Ambassador Stephen Piper is with us. He's among a number calling for lethal aid to Ukraine now, including former Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot. We've got Ivo Dalder on here, another U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, John Herbst, Michelle Flournoy, and more. Active conversation in Washington. Stephen Piper, please stand by there. With us as well now from Washington is Eugene Rumer, director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the U.S. National Intelligence Council, co-author of Conflict in Ukraine, The Unwinding of the Post-Cold War Order, comes out later this month. Eugene Rumer, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So you see the case that's being made by Stephen Piper and others, not insignificant names in Washington, saying it's time, lethal aid. What do you say?
I disagree. I think the proposal, and this is going to sound somewhat contradictory, is both inadequate and dangerous. It is inadequate to change Putin's mind, and it is dangerous because it can very, very really put us on a path of further escalation and possible conflict with Russia. Make no mistake that these weapons that are called defensive, you know, they're not defensive to those who are on the receiving end of those weapons. I think we're looking at a situation where we could end up inadvertently moving up the escalation ladder that Steve says we're guaranteed not to move up, without really fully understanding all the consequences. How do we control, for example, the distribution of these weapons? Who will be in charge of it? The report says that it's up to the defense attaché's office in Kyiv to do so. Well, that's U.S. military personnel in a conflict zone. Need I say more? Who is going to train the Ukrainian military in the use of these weapons? American trainers? Again, American boots on the ground. All of these raises more questions than the report meaningfully answers. And I have to say, really, it's somewhat disappointing to see a report by so many prominent individuals really leave out so many gaps. And as to the gaps in the Ukrainian military capabilities, I think we're looking at a situation with the Ukrainian military where the gaps are so much greater than anything that the United States is prepared to provide can cover in a short period of time.
But what's the U.S. supposed to do? If you let this happen here, who knows how far Russia goes? Maybe they want all of Ukraine back. Then what? We see it again, Russian forces backing separatists in Latvia and Estonia, all along the edge of the former Soviet Union. That's the scenario that's being suggested as the onward danger here. Eugene?
Well, let me just say that, you know, proposing an inadequate solution is not a solution for a situation that I think really is. I agree with the report's author, is dangerous. I think we need to think about the consequences of what they're proposing. Now, as to what the real dangers are, yes, I think there are real possibilities, you know, real threats to Ukraine. Those are the kinds of threats that the Ukrainian military right now simply is not able to defend their country against.
So we're supposed to just sit back and let it happen? We tried the economy front, and it's been a brutal punishment for Russia and no impact.
Right. So I think there are several avenues that I believe we're not pursuing sufficiently vigorously. One is to do anything to freeze the conflict. We have to stop the bleeding. And Corey Flintoff's report about the feelings, the despair of the people in eastern Ukraine really speaks to that.
But we tried. We went to Minsk. We got a ceasefire agreement, you know, inconsequential.
Right. And I think this is a situation where we need to get involved a lot more directly and at much, much higher levels than we've been willing to engage so far. So I think this really calls for a direct conversation between the White House and the Kremlin. We know from multiple reports from Russia that right now Putin is really the key decider, as he usually is. But on these issues, he really is the decider, and there's no substitute for engaging with him directly. It's difficult, but I don't see any other way. Two, I think we need to be providing a lot more economic assistance to the government in Kyiv. So far, our commitment is really to provide about $3 billion in loan guarantees, which is by orders of magnitude short of where Ukraine's needs are for the coming year and beyond. We need to be doing more.
Eugene Rumer, stand by right there. Many callers here. Eileen in Southbury, Connecticut. Eileen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Okay, first I'd like to start off with the perspective of the Russian people. It's impossible to really get any accurate perspective, because they're not, you know, they're not being told. They're not even allowed to speak their mind, and they're not being, and everything is being hidden from them as usual. Putin is a former KGB. His grandfather actually cooked for Stalin.
Take us to the issue, Eileen. Take us to the issue of should we get in there with lethal arms?
We should ask Clinton. Clinton saw the 1994 Budapest Treaty. He was very diplomatic. This was a strategy. They had the world's third largest nuclear arsenal at the fall of the USSR. And, America got in there, meddled in their business.
What we said, give up your nuclear weapons and we'll guarantee some kind of guarantee on your security.
Yeah, guarantee security assurance, boots on the ground.
Yeah.
Tom?
Yes, please. Steve Pfeiffer?
Actually, Strobtaub and I actually negotiated the Budapest Memorandum,
mm-hmm.
and it provided an American security assurance. We used that term, not guarantee, and we told the Ukrainians we were not giving you a guarantee of American troops, but we did say that we would provide assurances and commit to respect their sovereignty, territorial integrity, and independence, and the Russians have violated that. I think that imposes an obligation on the United States to respond. I would like to make just two brief points in response to Gene's points.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
First of all, our group did seriously think through, are there risks of escalation? And there are. But we considered at the end that the risks of inaction, which I think is what Gene is suggesting, are much greater than the risks of action. The second point, I think it is a false argument to say that somehow the United States gets on this escalatory ladder that automatically leads to nuclear war. There are places that we can stop. You don't do stupid stuff, and we can make smart decisions to protect ourselves.
But how do we keep from getting in? You know the old in for a dime, in for a dollar. You give some lethal aid, it doesn't quite work out, then you give more, then Russia pushes back, and pretty soon it's tit for tat. People's honor gets on the line. Americans have been there before, Ambassador.
Yeah, we have, and again, but we don't have to necessarily proceed down that path. And again, our group was very clear, no American boots on the ground. The training issues, actually there are plans for American troops to train battalions of the Ukrainian National Guard that all scheduled to take place at Yavoriv, which is on the Polish border as far away as you can get from the conflict zone. You know, this does not have to expose Americans in any kind of way.
Eugene, we have half a minute before the break. Escalation, escalation won't happen because it can't. No boots on the ground. How would it escalate if it did?
Well, imagine, somebody from the defense attaché's office that Steve referred to and the report referred to, is going out to monitor the use of these weapons, which is what the report calls for. Let's say, they take the wrong turn on a poorly marked road and, end up in the hands of the separatists. What happens then? Do we mount a search and rescue mission in the territory? I don't know. I think that's something that the report needs to address, and it's a major, major gap in this conversation.
Eugene Rumer, please stand by. Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, we're talking about arming Ukraine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Imagine having a personal library with over 150,000 titles. Fiction, nonfiction, bestsellers, every category imaginable. Now imagine having a personal assistant read them to you in your car, on the train, wherever you want. That's what it's like to have Audible.com. On Point listeners get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint. Download a free title and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. Get started today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about arming Ukraine, giving lethal aid, arms, to the government now under heavy attack by Russian-backed separatists there. There's a new call for it just today Ashton Carter, who is in hearings to become the next U.S. Secretary of Defense, saying he is inclined to offer arms in his testimony on Capitol Hill. It is a live issue. Former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Stephen Pieper is with us from Washington today, one of eight prominent names in Washington, including former Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbott and others, who have signed a report saying it's time. Eugene Rumer is with us from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He says, no, this won't work. Lots of comments from our listeners here. James says, I don't get why we're playing real-life Stratego with the Russians. They're a pseudo-dictatorship, petrostate with a demographic problem and income inequality. The idea, I guess, they're going down. They'll go down on their own. Omaha guy writes to us, all Russian gains in Ukraine are temporary. Mr. Putin is creating the situation that is going to make Russia temporary. Well, I don't know about that. And what about American commitments here? I want to bring into our conversation right now from Washington, Anders Åslund, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He looks at economic policy in Russia, Ukraine, Eastern Europe, has been an advisor, economic advisor to Russia and to Ukraine, co-editor of the just-published book, The Great Rebirth, Lessons from the Victory of Capitalism Over Communism. Anders Åslund, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
Why haven't economic sanctions plus the plummeting oil prices brought unbearable pressure to bear on Russia? Why hasn't that worked here?
Well, I think that it is working quite hard. And perhaps a reason for the current Russian offensive that we are seeing in Ukraine is that President Putin sees that he will not be able to hold this up for very long. Right now, most forecasts suggest that Russian GDP will fall by 5% this year. It could be much more.
Do you expect to see political consequences of that in Russia? Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe Putin is so insulated from any kind of political pressure that he's free to pursue any policy, regardless of the economic cost to the Russian country, the people.
This is the big question that we don't have an answer to, because during the last 15 years, when President Putin, in effect, has been in power, he has benefited from a massive oil boom, and therefore the standard of living has increased massively. During 10 years, Russia's standard of living rose steadily. GDP increased 10 times in dollar terms. And now, for the first time, we are seeing since November that the standard of living is steadily falling. I think this will bite, and we will see political reactions to it.
If it bites, what? I mean, here we're looking at lethal aid. While we have our finger on that trigger, looking at what might happen in the economy, if it bites, what would that look like? What would the evidence of the bite be? I mean, we've already got falling GDP, and still Putin's large and in charge.
Well, there is an outstanding professor of sociology in Moscow, Natalia Zubarevich. She argues that the soft spot in Russia, socially, that is the big industrial cities that are not the biggest ones. From a quarter to 1 million people, where 30% of the population live, these are the places where we should expect social unrest.
Social unrest. Putin seems to have been pretty adept at squelching that. You'd have to get to the scale of some kind of revolt to get his attention. Is that a possibility?
Well, the Minister of Economy of Russia now is suggesting is that real wages are likely to fall by 9% this year and real incomes by 6% if the oil price stays at the current level.
Revolt?
We don't know this. What we do know is that repression is very efficient in Russia. It's not very crude. It's more information and money. And if the money is not there, then you can't bribe the people so easily.
Ambassador Pieper, maybe we should just wait. Maybe with the economic sanctions and oil fall, you know, so steep, maybe that will bite even Vladimir Putin at some point here. Unrest, uprising, and he'll have problems in his own backyard. No need for lethal arms.
Well, I think there is still a good chance that the economic sanctions will work over time, and that's the important question. I mean, Mr. Putin has responded to the sanctions by trying to rally the population, and in the short term, I think he's had some success. But if the sanctions and if the West can maintain its unity and its determination on the sanctions, what happens 6 to 12 months down the road? And does Mr. Putin begin to get nervous that his public support is eroding? But I think the sanctions impact is mainly in the mid to longer term. And if you look at the military situation and what's happening on the ground in eastern Ukraine right today,
there's a much more urgent need on the Ukrainian side.
Well, what is the rush there? I mean, to get the U.S. involved here is a big deal in this way, so the Russians take, I don't know, another 10 miles of Ukraine. Is that of great strategic significance to the U.S., NATO?
Well, again, the question is, how far do they go, and how far are you prepared to let them go? Again, we would argue that the risk of providing military assistance, most of which would be non-lethal to the Ukrainians, is a manageable risk, and it does give an opportunity for the Ukrainians to begin to change the calculation in Moscow, and hopefully greater costs on the battlefield combined with the impact of the financial sanctions bring Moscow sooner rather than later to what they should be doing, which is working with Ukraine on a negotiated outcome.
Anders Oslin, you are our economist here. One moment, please. Anders, the cost of the conflict in Ukraine, is it significant to Moscow in economic terms?
Hardly. This doesn't cost very much.
Eugene?
Yeah, I think actually I agree with Steve in one sense. I don't believe that just sitting and waiting is the right answer here and, you know, waiting for the sanctions to work. It will take a long time because, you know, we don't know how they'll work. It's unpredictable.
Well, they're biting deeply already along with oil,
biting,
but the consequences,
but
who knows? So what would you do?
Well, what I said earlier, I think we should do, we should engage very actively in negotiations, in a conversation with the Russians about the terms for ending this conflict.
What's going to bring them to the table?
Let me just... Sorry?
Easy to say that, but they're not at the table. I mean,
well, we should engage them. We should put them, you know, we should come to their table.
Maybe arms would bring them. That's the suggestion here.
That, in my view, is not going to work. If anything, it's going to make them to double down. In the meantime, what I think is going to happen is that the Ukrainian economy will collapse. That's in a much more fragile state than the Russian economy. So we need to be doing much more than we have so far to help Poroshenko and his government to push through the reforms. That's one. Two, I think we really need to think about ways, creative ways to deliver humanitarian assistance to eastern Ukraine to show that we're not indifferent to that situation.
Stephen Pieper, what is it in the introduction of arms and more support here that you think would change the mind of apparently the only mind that matters here, Vladimir Putin's? What would the thing he would see? He seems so intransigent here. What would he see in the aftermath of this new support from the U.S. coming in that would make him say, okay, let's negotiate?
I think there are two factors. One, the prospect that further Russian aggression in eastern Ukraine means further Russian casualties, and I think there is a threshold beyond which he does not want to go on that score. But second, it's a demonstration that the West is prepared to push back, that he does not have easy policy gains against Ukraine or perhaps elsewhere. And I think that's an important message to say, that the West needs to send a message to Mr. Putin that this kind of behavior is egregious, it violates the post-Cold War security order, and there needs to be punishment for this kind of behavior.
Stephen Pieper, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, thank you very much for being with us today from the Brookings Institution.
Thank you.
Anders Oslin at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Oslin.
Thank you. My pleasure, Tom.
And Eugene Rumer at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks for joining us, Eugene.
Good to be with you.
Ashton Carter, who's up for defense secretary, is saying today he is inclined to offer arms to Ukraine. Watch this space. In a moment, Jordan retaliates. Two jailed jihadists hanged at dawn. The execution's retribution after ISIS sets a fire and kills a Jordanian pilot. This is On Point. News early today that Jordan has executed two prominent Iraqi jihadists just hours after ISIS released a gruesome video, apparently showing the burning death of a Jordanian pilot in a cage. Jordan had tried unsuccessfully to secure the release of the pilot through a prisoner exchange. Already high tensions in the region are now higher still. Taylor Luck joins us now from Amman, Jordan, correspondent there for The Washington Post. Taylor Luck, thank you very much for being with us. What is the mood in Amman after this series of killings, the burning, the hanging, and all the rest in the streets, first of all? What's the attitude, Taylor?
Well, Tom, great to be with you. First of all, the release of the video triggered clamors for vengeance in the Jordanian public. And that vengeance took in the form of the executions of Sajid al-Rishawi and Zayd Karbouli, two al-Qaeda militants who are part of failed prisoner swaps between Jordan and the Islamic State. Now, of course, the two had been enjoying a stay on their execution for over a decade, and that stay ended today at dawn. The real question is now, are these executions enough to answer the rising calls for blood for their fallen pilot?
We've heard the calls for blood in tape from the streets, but we've also heard Jordanians saying, why are we in the middle of this and, you know, getting our pilots burned in cages? Let's get out of this coalition.
Well, one thing that's interesting to see now is that this anti-war movement, which had been building throughout the hostage crisis, is now starting to be silencing out slowly and slowly. One of the important aspects of the video was not only the killing of Kassaspra, but at the end of the video, the Islamic State listed the names of Jordanian pilots and provided satellite images of their homes in Jordan and called on their supporters to attack them. So for Jordan and Jordanians, even the most ardent critics of the coalition, this is an undeniable act of war. And what we're actually seeing now is growing support for the war. People who had previously thought that this is America's war are now coming out and saying that we ourselves are threatened and we must act.
If Jordan wants to double down in its efforts against Islamic State, how would it do that exactly, Taylor?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of vague hints in the last 24 hours. The Jordanian government spokesperson said that there will be earth-shattering response. The armed forces said that they would respond to this act. And even in the state-run print media, they're openly discussing sending ground troops to Syria. So what we're really seeing now is a nation preparing its people for war, increased airstrikes. And what's really being expected is at least special operation forces entering into Syria. This is a scenario now being debated publicly and in many ways preparing Jordanians for an increased sacrifice, an increased role in the coalition.
Wow, that sounds pretty incredible. Now, one of the jihadists killed hung this morning, Sajida al-Rishawi. This was an Iraqi woman who was convicted. She was part of a hotel bombing attack in Amman a decade ago. Her bomb didn't go off, but I've read she was tied into Islamic State leadership right up to the very top. What about ISIS, the Islamic State, taking its own revenge here? What options does it have?
Well, their options are very limited. There are concerns that they might try to encourage their supporters to carry out acts in Jordan. But Jordan has been implementing a series of crackdowns, rounding up anyone with any ties with the Islamic State. Even kids opening up Islamic State statements or Twitter feeds or Facebook have been put into prison since 2 to 3 years. So Jordan has been taking preemptive steps to ensure local security. I've talked to officials, and they've expressed concern of Jordanians abroad, Jordanians in other Arab states, perhaps in Africa and Europe, and that we might see targeting of Jordanian citizens. And that's the major concern right now.
Taylor, I'm sorry to ask you to do this, but could you describe a little bit of the video with the Jordanian pilot? Many people have not seen it, but it was described as gruesome. We know there was a burning. What did it show?
Well, I can't describe in detail. I've only seen bits of it because a lot of it has been blocked here in Jordan, but it does show Moab Kassaspra in a cage. First, he's a parade in front of masked gunmen. He delivers a long speech explaining his operations in Syria, that he had bombed El-Rika and other places. He's placed in a cage. Unfortunately, he's doused in gasoline, burnt alive, and then a bulldozer comes and demolishes the cage. It's a long video segment, professionally done. But again, one of the major points of it was highlighting the other pilots in the coalition. And it basically was a warning statement to them that the Islamic State will reach them not only in Syria, but in their home countries as well.
If there is this bloodlust in Jordan now for revenge, you say that talk even of special operations forces, Jordanian forces going into Syria, what might their targets be, A, and B, would the Syrian government of Assad welcome that, or would that be seen as an invasion?
That's a very interesting question. There's really two scenarios being discussed right now. One is direct pinpoint operations where the Islamic State strongholds are, such as El-Rika and near Aleppo. The other scenario being discussed is support for the Free Syrian Army in southern Syria, creating a buffer zone to ensure the Islamic State does not reach Jordan's borders. Now, do either of those scenarios sound appealing to the Syrian government and also to Iran and Hezbollah? That's a very good question. And I think that will be one to be played out at the regional level to see if whether Jordan or Amman will be given the green light by Damascus to actually go in. I mean, I have to remind you that Jordan is a Sunni Muslim state, and I think their entrance would be seen as a threat by Damascus and perhaps Iran as well.
And what about the risks to Jordan? Is Jordan at risk of Islamic State attack and invasion, pushing it the other way, right into their turf?
Well, I think it would be difficult. Like I said, Jordan has been mounting a campaign the past 6 months, cracking down on supporters at home and apparently providing a lot of intelligence and logistic support to the coalition. I think the Islamic State's capability of carrying out attack similar to the 2005 Al-Qaeda triple hotel bombing that Jordan saw in 2005 will be difficult and limited. Now, it is also good to mention that 2,000 Jordanians, between 1,500 and 2,000, are currently in the ranks of Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. But in terms of supporters here, it's very few. Their ground forces or foot soldiers that are Jordanian have all gone off to Syria and Iraq. It'd be difficult for them to operate in Jordan. So I think that basically their ability to operate has been limited. And I think as officials have expressed a concern that Jordanians may be targeted outside of Jordan. And that would be the act of revenge.
Days of shocking violence. A pilot burned alive in a cage. Jordanians out in the streets enraged. Two jihadists in Jordan hung at dawn in retaliation, and now calls for revenge out of Jordan. Taylor Luck with The Washington Post says up to and including sending Jordanian special operations forces into Syria. Talk about a region on edge. Taylor Luck, Washington Post correspondent based in Amman. Thank you very much for being with us today, Taylor.
Thank you so much, Tom. My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.